Daily news, breaking updates, and exclusive podcasts. iTricks.com.
Welcome, everyone, back to another iTricks Magic Week in Review. This is your host, Michael Lauk, sitting here in beautiful downtown St. Louis, Missouri, the center of the magic world, no matter what anybody else tells you. And this week, we are joined with Mr. Rob Zabrecki, who is on the line with me now.
Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. And we are going to talk about a whole bunch of things. But one of the ones I'd like to start with, if it's all right with you, is how you became a magician, because I have a feeling that your journey's a little bit different than most of the guys that we've talked to in the past. And let's start that by saying I saw you perform years ago, but not as a magician, but as a musician when you were with Possum Dixon. How does one – have you always been into magic, or did it come later?
It came by complete accident. I had no interest idea that I was going to be getting interested in magic and then eventually reinventing myself as a magician until I did my first trick, which was the first day I learned that trick in Baltimore in the mid-1990s.
All right. So you set off as a young man to be a musician, I assume.
That was it. That was my childhood dream. I think as most magicians were fumbling, you know, through magic kits in their bedrooms, I was another kid of a different ilk who was probably jumping around with a tennis racket to Kiss and Cheap Trick records.
And that's because guys in bands get more girls than magicians, right?
You know what? I got to be honest. I never really thought about that, but it might have been a factor.
And you were, you know, you were fairly successful. Like I told you off the air, I am dead sure I saw you, and, you know, and I think I mentioned on the air already years ago. Maybe did you tour with Horton Heat?
Yep, we okay. Sure did. Yeah, that was one of our most disastrous tours in our 10 years of playing live music as a live band. That was definitely the most challenging and difficult tour that we ever did.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad to bring up such fond memories for you.
Well, you know what? It was interesting because it was one of those moments where, you know, when you're an opening band, you have to sort of stand before the headlining band's audience, and hopefully at some point in your set they're going to like you and you're going to maybe, you know, win over a few fans and they might go out and buy your record, or, you know, maybe they're going to love you from the first song you play and they're going to get right on board with what you're doing. Or, you know, in the case of Reverend Horton Heat, some audiences actually threw beer bottles at us and spit directly into my face repeatedly throughout our set. So that was a challenge, you know, to get through those. There was two really, really bad nights and then a few others, which weren't so bad. I don't know what show you saw or what the response was like when you were there, but there were just a couple of nights that were just absolutely dreadful and made me really question the concept of being a live performer.
Well, that is unfortunate, but if you don't mind, can we talk about that for a second?
I'm always happy to talk about those shows because they just bring back the weirdest memories. You know, we were basically a headlining club act for our first record. Possum Dixon was an early band that put out three albums on Interscope Records in the early 1990s. And basically, we got off to a good start. We had a song on the radio, and we had a pretty decent little college following. And then we started to kind of fall apart for different reasons. And at that point, started opening it for bands that were doing a little bit better than us, which in this case was the Reverend Horton Heat. They got recently signed to Interscope Records. We were on the same label, and it, you know, makes sense a lot of times for labels to pair up, you know, touring bands and throw them out as a kind of a package deal. And that was the case with Possum Dixon and Reverend Horton Heat. And, you know, on paper, Reverend Horton Heat was, for those of you that don't know, are primarily a rockabilly band, a really fast paced, good rockabilly band who are terrific live. And the name Possum Dixon sounds like a southern kind of country-esque band. There's something about those words, Possum Dixon, that people always kind of thought we had a country thing going on. So they saw us and they realized that there was very little of that influenced our band. Anyway, so on paper, it made sense. And first couple shows were okay, but then we got to Boston. And I just remember walking out on stage, and there was about 1,000 people packed into this club. I can't remember what club it was. But I walked into the spotlight, and the second I hit the light and I got before the microphone, a bottle of Budweiser beer came twirling right in my head. I could just see it. It was like a bat. It came at me so fast. I barely had enough time to duck. Well, what is that? Oh, God, that's a heavy object. That's a bottle. Ka-plang! And it explodes on stage, and there's foam and glass everywhere. And I went, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening. And I looked to the other guys, and they looked at me like, well, let's do this. So we launched into our first song, and a couple songs later, another one comes from a different side of the stage. And these guys, they hated us. The audience for Reverend Horton Heat, for reasons I can only guess, kind of despised what we were doing. And mainly, I would say, we were definitely a pop group that was influenced by a lot of the early new wave and kind of punk rock bands that came out of the New York in the 1970s. And that's all fine and good if you're headlining your own show or playing with bands that are like-minded. But the rockabilly crowd has a different, they're a whole different audience. I won't call them narrow-minded, but they're definitely specific in what they like. And they like rockabilly music. And if you play rockabilly music, that's probably all fine and good. But we were not to their liking. And so they hurled some bottles that night, and it was a nightmare. And two nights later, you know, we're in Rhode Island. And same thing happens. We're like, okay, let's just get through this tour, you know. And we love the band. The band were really great. They're really sweet to us. And they're like, man, I'm sorry, rough audience tonight. You know, I walk up to the microphone, and this little burly rockabilly guy, looks like a Johnny Cash kind of guy, and his buddy walk right in front of the microphone, where, you know, center stage, kind of through a heavy crowd of people, and just start spitting loogies in my eye. Right into my face, like perfect. This guy had a perfect launch with his spit. And I don't know, I'm not a fighter. You know, I'm like, what am I doing here? This is insane. I get spit on a couple times. I look at the other band members, and who are my best friends and school friends for many, many years. And they go, so Bracky, come on, man, don't wimp out. Let's get through this. Just do it. Just play, ignore those guys. And I'm thinking, easy for you to say, you know, they're not spitting in your face, you know. But I, you know, for some reason, I listened to them, and I just kind of, I held on, and I just cringed through our, you know, 25-minute opening set. And that was the second night of just, you know, stuff like that happens when you're kind of following your dreams, and you're doing what you know, supposedly love what you should be doing, and you're following your kind of light in life. And then something like that happens, and you go, wait a second. Either maybe what I'm doing is awful and terrible, or maybe these guys are just, they hate what I'm doing for whatever reason. But it makes you question what you're doing and why you're up to doing it, because you can't really, it's hard to love what you're doing when an audience is having a violent reaction to your presence.
Yeah, I mean, okay, having grown up in the Midwest punk rock scene, which segued right into the rockabilly resurgence, and, you know, Horton Heat particularly was very much in that punk rock rockabilly line. And, you know, and you mentioned the 70s punk rock bands. That's a kind we're coming firmly from the 80s punk rock bands, the hardcore. And particularly you hit towns like Boston. Boston hates 70s New York punk. Boston hates
right,
New York.
Of course.
But
good point.
And it was a time, I mean, frankly, I remember seeing, I've seen so many bands in that right around that time where it was just like, why, who connected these two? And I mean, I remember your band of this day. I actually kind of liked you guys, you know, it coming out of, like I said, more of a punk rock scene. I was, you know, you were catchy. Watch That Girl Destroy Me. That's you guys, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I remember, yep. I mean, you know, I think I remember seeing you on Letterman or something like that later, you know, but.
Yeah. We made the rounds on those shows. Yeah.
But I can see where some towns that would have been tough, and somebody from your record label should have been like, "Hey, you know what? this might not be a great idea."
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't know it was going to be a bad idea until it was clearly a bad idea. So you know, that was the lesson that we kind of learned from. There, I don't think we had too many more openings. Well, we actually did. We did a few more tours, but we realized that if we were going to go out with bands, that we were going to—they'd be a little more broad in the audience band, where it wasn't going to be as sort of narrow-minded. And I'm not saying the rockabilly audience is narrow-minded. I'm saying those particular people at those shows were absolutely narrow-minded, and it was just like really weird, you know. And the whole concept of punk rock is thinking for yourself and having your own idea and your own sort of individuality and finding your point of view to present whatever art it is to your audience. And as that music developed over time, it just became more narrow-minded. It certainly happened in Los Angeles, where if you didn't look a certain way or act a certain way, you were going to get beat up. And I think that kind of bled over to the rockabilly fans as well, where it was very specific. We didn't have the mutton chops and the little, you know, the Elvis hairdo and maybe a lower, you know, like a old vintage truck and the right Levi's. You kind of weren't, you know, you didn't fit into the mold of what that was supposed to be like.
Yeah, well, you know, there's definitely a big skinhead move between to the rockabilly team,
yeah,
and, which doesn't help.
And that. Yes, it doesn't. Yeah, which is couldn't be more narrow-minded and you know, kind of wrong in every way. So I think those people didn't, you know, I think they saw us as a little like we were a little maybe too light on our feet. Let's just say, you know, we were like just too soft. Basically, is what, you know. That's just they were probably had a few beers in them. They were drunk. They're like, this ain't what I came to see. Let's get it off the stage by doing this. And whether it was spit or throwing bottles, that was the reaction. You know, I gotta say, in magic, that doesn't really happen.
Yeah, that was actually my next question is, does that make like the worst gig in magic be like, hey, you know, the rabbit crapped in my hat, oh well.
Exactly. Well, you know what, yeah, exactly. My worst nightmare performance in magic was nothing even close to those gigs. So I guess if I had to look back, I would say those years of performing gave me kind of a thick skin as a performer, and I'm not really scared to walk out in front of people and try new things.
Now, let's talk about the segue between there a little more. I know you've done some acting since. Has acting always been a part of your life, or is that something you've picked up with magic?
Absolutely. I was performing magic for a good 7 years. I fell into magic through music, and then I was performing one night. I remember the night really well, actually. I was performing, doing a set at the Magic Castle in the museum, and I kind of was building up an act. I really wanted to perform in the parlor, and I was kind of, you know, working on an act for that room, you know, a 20-minute kind of parlor act. And one of my good friends, John Lovick, also known as Handsome Jack, kind of pulled me aside and was like, you know, what you're doing is, you know, I like what you're doing. It's really good. And you're kind of acting, you know, you're developing this character, and you might want to think about doing some acting. You know, we're here in L.A. Why not give it a shot? And he really put that idea into my head. And it wasn't like I hadn't thought of it before, but it was like, okay, I'll think about that. You know, when I came home and I talked to my wife about it, and she was like, she couldn't have been more enthusiastic about just exploring the concept of kind of using the skills I'd acquired as a magician, which require, you know, learning scripts and a certain amount of blocking and movement to put that into, acting. So I caught the bug of acting shortly afterwards and joined the theater company and kind of just jumped right into it. I started doing little commercials and short films and eventually, put some network television spots and national commercials and I'm kind of finding my way, you know, as an actor right now. And it's been a really exciting journey. And I would say it was because of that night. I can actually point to that night as a touchstone moment as a look into, you know, a new room that I hadn't really explored.
Okay. And believe it or not, we're already to about the halfway point. So if you can sit tight for a sec, we'll take a break. And if everybody out there can sit tight for a sec and listen to this, we'll be right back with Rob Zabrecki in just a second.
Hello, this is Michael again with my little friend Paco. Paco, can you speak? Speak, boy. Come on, speak. Speak. Okay, the one time I want the Chihuahua to bark, he's not actually going to bark. But I'm going to assure you that Paco wishes to join me in urging everyone out there to support your local no-kill animal shelter. Paco has been a part of our family for 8 or 9 years now, and despite the 8 or 9 years of otherwise constant barking, he's been a real important part of the family. And we love the little guy. And there's lots of little guys out there that need your love who haven't done anything wrong except for being born to irresponsible pet owners. So no matter where you live, I guarantee there is a no-kill animal shelter in your area and that they need your help. So if you have time, if you have money, if you have inclination, if you're looking for a great charity, support your local no-kill animal shelter. Thanks. And Paco thanks you too.
iTricks.com.
Hello, it's Michael, and we are back with Rob Zabrecki. Now, Rob, before the break, we were talking about how you've kind of segued from magic, well, from music to magic, and now more into acting. Are you finding that being a magician is helping you as an actor, or are you finding that taking up acting is helping you more as a magician, or are you just kind of finding that this is the way you're going, so you're not sure any other way, if that makes sense?
My magic has helped acting immeasurably, mainly because in magic, you know, we have to learn scripts and we have to learn how to perform those scripts. And then we have, you know, let's just say blocking or whatever your blocking is. So all of those things are things that we do, you know, you do in acting. It's exactly the same. Where it gets a little tricky for me is, you know, for 10 years in magic, I was and still do write a lot of my material. So it's one thing when you write your own material and you memorize your own material. But when somebody hands you a script and you've got to learn it, you know, let's just say word perfect, word for word, it's a little more. I think if I came to acting, you know, as a kid, it would have been a lot easier to memorize scripts in that way. Because I try to learn all my material, you know, perfectly, so I know exactly where all the beats are, and it's really helpful for me. So anyway, the point is, acting has helped out magic a ton, and my magic has helped, but they go back and forth. They really help each other. And the more I delve into each one, the more I seem to kind of, it's more satisfying. The more time I spend on both of them, the more gratifying it feels.
So then, I almost feel like I'm putting you on the spot or almost insulting you. And I don't want to insult you with this, but if acting were to pick up, is magic something that might get left behind, or are you I mean, are you a magician first? Are you an actor first, or do you know?
I do know, and that's not insulting at all, really. I mean, I'm an entertainer. I'm not good at giving myself a magician tag. I reserve that term for kids who stayed home on their, you know, prom nights to work on their double lifts or their, you know, their Vernon cups and balls or whatever. So I've never been big on calling myself a magician. I was never big on calling myself a musician either, because I never thought I was that good. So I think I'm good at entertaining. I think I'm good at putting together different kinds of material and stepping before audiences and taking them away out of their everyday lives, and doing that, you know. So I think that you know, if I love doing it all, you know, if a film comes along and it takes me a month to do that, I'm going to be working on that movie. But in the back of my mind, I know that I'm going to be trying to rewrite a script for an Out of This World routine that I'm working on. And, you know, conversely, if I'm working on a magic trick, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I'm thinking about maybe some lines that I've got for a movie that I've got coming up. My mind kind of works really well with jogging a few things around. And I like to have some of the, you know, a little bit of each on my plate. I've always got a magic script and a magic routine that I'm working on. I've always got an acting thing that I'm working on. And it's really helpful for me. So they really do go hand in hand. You know, I don't think I would ever, if someone said, oh, for the next 10 years, I'm going to offer you movies, you know, until you're, you know, 55 years old. At first of all, I don't think that would happen. But if it did, I would have to really consider, you know, how that would affect my career in magic, because I love magic, and I reinvented myself as a magician at a time when I was kind of at a pretty low point. So magic's really important to me for a lot of reasons, and I love it. And I love the Magic Castle. You know, this is a place that's super dear to my heart. It's really close to my house, and it's a big part of my life. So magic, I would say, I mean, I can't predict the future. I might make it tomorrow and quit both. Who knows? But they're both really important in my life for different reasons.
So there's a possibility tomorrow you wake up and you're like IndyCar racing.
There's a very small chance that could happen. I guess I just try to stay open-minded, and in that you have to know that, like, you know, people change. You know, as a 10-year-old kid, there's no way I would have ever thought that I have the life that I have now. So I have to be open-minded that anything can happen, because anything did happen. It did happen to me. The weirdest thing that could have happened to me. I became a magician. That's just a freak accident as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I'm not saying that I'm going to give all this up for, you know, geology, you know, in the year 2016 or anything like that, but I just don't know. And I think part of the fun in life is not knowing around what each corner is. I think I'd be really bored to know that, you know, I would be doing, you know, this year, and then the next year I'd be putting up, you know, this book or that trick, and then put on this show. That's not really how I like to live anyways. I think it's more fun to just kind of keep open-minded and just let life kind of let your inspirations guide you. That's fun for me.
Okay. I'd like to ask you, since you love magic, which, I mean, you know, I'm not questioning that at all, and you consider yourself an entertainer primarily, are you a 24/7 magician? I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with that Jeff McBride kind of 24/7 magician theory. Are you a 24/7 magician, or are you you know, when I'm off the stage, now I'm Rob, I'm not Rob the magician?
That's a really good question. I often ponder that. I went to mystery school 10 years ago, and that was one of Jeff's big things. The Magi 24/7 pizza guy comes to your door, better be ready for a trick.
Wait a second. That is exactly him. I have sat by him and heard him say those exact words. Pizza guy comes to your door. Let's do a trick.
You better be ready for it. And he's probably telling someone that right now. I mean, that's his example. And I get it. And it's a fine example. But for me, I try. That's why I say it's a good question. I try to always be prepared to do something mysterious or magical. However, the first person that says to me, hey, you're coming to this thing, you got to do a trick, I'm the first guy to say, not a chance. because for me, magic, at least impromptu magic, happens best when no one's expecting it. And when someone says to me, "Hey man, I heard you're a magician, show me a trick," they will see nothing. I can almost guarantee that, because the mystery, that strips the mystery out of it. They're expecting to see something. They're waiting for a miracle to happen. And then the expectations are set, and I want no part of it. That's just a trap. That's like a hellish trap for me. But when someone's not expecting something, and I'm casually talking to them, and meanwhile I'm kind of doing something with my fingers, and I produce a small object or something happens that's mysterious, that's a moment they weren't expecting, and that's amazing. So I'm more like Magi 23-6, I guess.
No, that makes sense. I mean, I respect Jeff McBride's idea. I really do. But I feel like, yeah, personally, there's that fine line between being the annoying uncle, you know?
Right.
And
exactly.
But on the flip side, like, if you're ever stuck in a, and I've used this example before, but if you're ever stuck in line in like a grocery store behind the kids who are just like losing it, and you could tell mom's about to lose it because the kids, you know, and you can just like all of a sudden do something and just bring a little, you know, to use a hokey phrase, bring a little magic into their lives. That is, you know, one of the greatest things that can be accomplished with what we do. But on the flip side, you are so right about that kind of setup. And, you know, other careers don't have that. Nobody is like, "Hey, I, you know, you're an MMA fighter, punch me in the face." You know, I don't think that happens.
That's exactly right, and I say, and that's why I follow up to them, and I always follow up to anybody that kind of presents me with this, do something. I'm like, "And what do? Okay, you're a cook. Well, how about some French fries? Because I would love some French fries right now." And you know, it kind of makes them, and I don't say it to be insulting or to be rude, but it makes them hopefully look at this thing where they'd have to prepare this and think about this, and you know, it's a whole thing, and. I don't know. I don't know how it comes off to people, but it makes me feel good to say no, I'm not going to do something, because I say that with great respect for magic.
No, that completely makes sense. Now, does the entertainer in you try to get off of it in such a way that you at least kind of make them laugh? You make them, or.
No, and in fact, it's the opposite. I try to prove a point to hit one for the team for magic, to explain that, like, when somebody's waiting for something magical to happen, there's expectations, and you're often not going to make those expectations work. If I do a great card trick, they're going to want to see the card appear on the other side of the glass, because that's what David Blaine did on TV last week. So even though I might do this amazing version of Triumph or something, well, that ain't good enough. The other guy did it, and it was on a tape to a bus that drove by. Can't you do that? You know, and like that's just a nightmare. So again, you know, I think it's good to kind of explain that in layman's terms, and at least it's made a lot of sense to people that if they're talking, and some people don't get it, and they're sort of insulted. And I don't. It's too bad. I don't care about that.
No, I mean, I think that's a, you know, it's a perfectly valid reason, and it's a great, you know, it's a great point that I think so many people might too kind of fall into that like, well, I have to, if nothing else, I have to promote myself. You know, I have to be, but you make a really good point that I don't think you hear very often. So
yeah. Well, the other thing is, I perform so often at the Magic Castle, where the environment is so different. People go there because they want to see magic. They get dressed up. They're on a big date. They're probably going to have dinner. This is the big night out for them, and so they're walked through that door ready to be amazed, ready to be mystified, and they're like the perfect audience, and they want to be. They're ready for it, and they're excited for it, and they kind of, the enthusiasm is kind of preset. It's in place. You don't have to sort of explain yourself, or like, you know, it's the perfect setting. That's all.
Okay. I'm glad you said that. You know, I was going to talk to you about coming into Magic later, you know, later. I'm making this sound like, you know, you retired and you became a magician, you know, but instead, personally, in my Magic career, I used to perform, I used to run movie theaters and I'd perform there and people weren't expecting it. It was a nice kind of a bonus, but they were there to be entertained. You know, but it kind of took the pressure off me. And then I spent years performing as Santa. And I didn't perform as a magician being Santa or magic. I was Santa, and kids expected Santa. And I used magic to as a condiment to the performance. You know, we talk and they tell me what you want. And you're like, bam, here's – and then they're like, you know, holy crap, this might actually be Santa Claus. Wait a minute.
Yeah, right.
So for me, in my point of view, and I've done like straight gigs and I've done parties and, but I've kind of come away with a feeling that in a way, sometimes it's best if you're not the magician, you're the entertainment or whatever. And the magic is a bit of a surprise, but, and I've always wondered about somewhere like the castle where, I mean, magic's in the name for, you know,
right.
You know, if people like, if that makes a great environment or if that makes like a, you know, a huge bar that you have to hit or how that is. So I'm really interested to hear you, you know, say that.
I mean, it just perfectly sets the stage. That's all it really does. You know, you get an introduction or, you know, you set the room is set up to your liking and you come out and you do what you think is, you know, the right set for those people. And the Magic Castle is an ideal place for that because you're also, you know, you're in this Victorian setting and there's magic there's wonderful, you know, there's some just beautiful posters everywhere and the lighting is nice and it lends itself to you know, the right kind of setting that I think magic should be performed under.
Well, is that because it's, if you go to the castle, you're not just going to a magic show. You're really kind of going to a magic destination, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that's one part of it. But I think the general audience that goes to the Magic Castle, they feel like they're going to it's a private club for magicians and their guests and their friends. So they feel like they've been, however they got there, they've been ushered into this almost secret world. And then, you know, you say open sesame to this owl and there's the protocol of getting in and being dressed up and your boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, whatever, they're all dressed up and it's, you know, you're kind of in this, it's not like walking down to the, you know, the local bar and, you know, and seeing a rock band perform. It's a little more special than that. So I think all those things add up to this, this desire to want to see, you know, hopefully a captivating and interesting performance.
All right. Well, believe it or not, we are running up against the clock already.
I believe it.
Well, I don't. It seems like it's flown by to me. So, hopefully everybody out there listening is wanting more. And I'd like to invite at some time in the future for you to come back on the iTrix Magic Week in Review. Until then, where can all the listeners learn more about Rob Zabrecki?
Listeners can learn about Rob Zabrecki through probably my website, which is just my name. It's robzabrecki.com. There's some stuff on there. But, you know, the Google search is quickly becoming my website for it. It seems to be following me in ways that I'm unfamiliar with, but, you know, most things that I'm doing, whether they're movie projects or magic things or, you know, other people tweeting and Facebooking, it's the internet. It's a great place to learn about, entertainers that are working. And I think I probably, you know, fall into that category.
Okay, great. And, as far as the acting goes, I know sometimes people can, sometimes people can't. Are there any titles you can tell us to look out for yet?
Oh yeah, gladly. There's two movies I did last year will be coming out this year, and one of them I got to play my magic character in feature that I think Warner Brothers is putting out later this year. It's called Lost River. And it was written and directed by the actor Ryan Gosling. So that's one. And the second one is another feature, an indie feature, a horror movie called Decay. And that comes out also later this year. And I get to play, again, my weird magic character that I made up at the Magic Castle, along with my wife and, you know, just a lot of playing around at home. I've kind of come to this bizarre character. And it's been fun to get to have the opportunity to actually take this character that we came up with and play him in movies. It's fun. It's great.
Well, great. Everybody will look out for those, and we will look out for you. And then as far as magic, I mean, you're pretty much at the castle. You don't really, well, I mean, I get the impression you don't do a lot of touring. You're not going to make it to the magic capital of the world, St. Louis.
You know what? I do a lot of touring. Touring, and I do a lot of magic conventions. But those are just, you know, you bail for a few days, you do the gig, and you come back. I don't do lecture tours or anything like that. But I do like traveling. But LA is my home. This is where I live. This is home base. It always has been. And the Magic Castle is a huge part of that. So if I'm not working in the palace, I'm working in the close-up room, I'm doing the parlor or seances, or, you know, if not, I'm just screwing around in the basement with my friends, and I can usually be found up there a couple times a month. So I'm pretty easy to find.
All right, great. Well, thanks for talking with us today, and we'll talk with you again soon. And everybody out there listening, sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
I just wanted to say thanks for having me. It was really fun talking to you.
Okay, and everybody out there listening, for all the news in the world of magic, until next week when we bring you the next podcast, stick with us every day at itricks.com.